Welcome to episode 30 of The Godlearners, a podcast dedicated to reading and gaming in the mythical world of Glorantha. My name is Jörg.
And I am Ludovic, a.k.a. Lord Abdul. And today we have the most esteemed guests. Very excited to have Ian Cooper with us. Hi, Ian.
Hi, guys. How are you doing?
Good. We have a lot of people that it's amazing that after 30 episodes we haven't brought on the podcast yet, but if we had a list, you would definitely be somewhere at the top. But I'm happy to finally have you there. Although, of course, people who are new to the world of Glorantha with RuneQuest, the latest version, they have no idea who you are because your name isn't anywhere on that. But you are a big Glorantha name for those.
I got a name check in the starter set.
Oh, cool.
Because some of the material in there is derived from the Coming Storm in the Eleven Lights and some of it for Johnstown, for Companion and Kingdom of Heroes. So,
yeah. Well, we'll talk about all that very soon. But so first, present yourself.
Hey, my name is Ian Cooper. So I'm a long-time Glorantha fan since really we picked it up back in the kind of 70s. And it was in that kind of era we were moving away from D&D and we began to pick up Call of Cthulhu, RuneQuest, etc. and became big Chaosium fans. I played that for quite a while. I took, the usual sort of break in my 20s and then really into my 30s began to return to gaming and came back really to Glorantha in its guise as Hero Wars. So I've been keeping track on Greg's writing and output in the 90s, even though I wasn't actually actively playing. But yeah, came back with that and got slowly into writing through that. Had some early writing gigs of scenarios, then kind of worked with Greg directly on some stuff, and that kind of led me to then really being contributed to Isseries, then Moon Design Publications. The Moon Design Publications kind of then merged into Chaosium, and it was with Moon Design Publications that my sort of biggest works, which are some of you, your listeners will know, which is The Coming Storm and The Eleven Lights, which is a campaign that spans 1617 to 1625 and is set amongst the Red Cow clan of the Cincina tribe and really covers their struggles to survive the final days of the occupation by the Lunar Empire. And, has a big hero quest in The Eleven Lights where following the Great Winter, you are one of the groups that has enormous success in trying to free Orlanth. And there's a hero quest called The Three New Stars, where you bring three stars back into the sky, which enables some people to have, with your rights, Orlanth magic before Orlanth's finally freed at the Battle of Milran in 1624, when all of his the ring emerges and there are now 11 stars, hence the name The Eleven Lights, and you become one of the early hero bands of the Hero Wars.
Yeah, pretty epic. And these days, what are you doing?
So these days, I am the line editor for Quest Worlds, and Quest Worlds is the successor to Hero Wars and Hero Quest. And we hope to be out by, depending when you broadcast this, we should get the PDF for the book out by end of 23, beginning of 24. Just depends how much holiday schedules interrupt the final steps, and then we're hoping for sort of end of Q2 24 to get a print copy out.
Ooh, exciting. So let's start by asking the obvious question, which is, because that's probably going to be the title of the episode, what is Quest Worlds?
Yeah, it's a really good question, particularly for Chaosium fans who are quite often, BRP folks. So what is it and where does it come from a little bit, maybe? So I'll talk about the basics of the system first, and then maybe we'll go into the history bit after that. So in Quest Worlds, you are defined by a set of abilities. You don't have any attributes, just the abilities that you use. And there are three main types of abilities, basically. There are keywords, which let you do a broad range of things. So typically something like an occupation, like a police officer, a culture, which might be, British, whatever it is in your fantasy setting. And then a community. So, you know, I'm a member of the God Learners podcast community, right? and then you have some standalone abilities, which are crazy well things that you can do and some flaws. And pretty much everything you do in the game is defined by those abilities. And we essentially, you can, during the game, if something comes up where you have an ability, it's either an assured contest. Anyone who's has that ability should be confident enough to do it. Can be very useful in investigations, right? Or there's a kind of contest, which basically means you, however big the thing you want to do, we just roll the dice once, and it's an opposed roll against the GM. Or what we call now a sequence, which means, hey, we really want to break this team down task by task, blow by blow. So we'll have a series of rolls, and we will tally the result, the outcome of one roll, and keep tallying until we reach an outcome. There are different tallying systems motivated by the game. So the basic thing is an opposed D20 roll, right? So you are a D20, you are a D20. If you get your ability or under, you succeed. If you get exactly the ability, we now call that a big success. If you get over that, you fail, right? And at the end, we just compare the number of successes. So if I roll a big success, I might have two, and you roll a success, I beat you. Or if I roll a success and you fail, I beat you. And if we both get the same number of successes, it's the highest dice roll wins. And if we want to, we can think about the difference of successes as indicating the quality of the result. We don't have to do that all the time, but we can if we want to understand quality of the result. But if you win the contest, you always get the prize, whatever is agreed the contest is. We don't nerf it. We don't say, no, you don't really get it. You get something close to it. You get the thing, right? So if you know, you and I are having basically a legal contest, and it's basically who will win or lose the legal fight. Well, I'm going to win, right? No matter how marginal it is. But the degree of success, if it's only zero, right? So what happens if it's zero? It's the highest roll wins. So if you've got the same number of successes, the highest dice roll wins. And then essentially it would be, well, if it's 0 degrees of difference, it's marginal. So I don't get huge costs awarded against me, effectively. The judge may think my lawsuit was a bit frivolous, even though I won, et cetera, right? Use that throughout. And that's the mechanic.
Yeah, and the mechanic is sort of very similar to how Pendragon works for people who are familiar with that, but there's a few extra, like it's in a more narrative interpretation of the Pendragon mechanics.
Yeah, so I mean, you can definitely draw this line, right? I can actually talk about this. And at one side of the line, you have kind of BRP and RuneQuest, right? In the middle, you've got something like Pendragon, and then you keep going along and you get basically to Questworld. So it's a Greg Stafford influence system. Robin Laws wrote the original system for Greg. But there's definitely, you can see Greg's influence on the game, and even more so, I think, a little bit now. And also we've exchanged DNA, right? Augments, which are now in RuneQuest Glorantha, came from Questworlds. And, you know, there's a little bit of to and fro in kind of like our exchange of ideas. So people who play Pendragon will usually find it quite accessible.
Yeah. Can you talk a bit about the masteries, which is the sort of thing that also allows Questworld to sort of scale to god level?
So one thing we've done in Questworld is try and make the rules more coherent and simplify them from the past, right? So we found what we did was in order to write what we call the system reference document, which is essentially you can just use that content directly. It contains, no, we're now under an alt license. And an alt license, you worry about a thing called reserved content, which is essentially the trademark stuff, right? The SRD is completely clean of that, so you don't have to worry about that. But in order to strip the original game down, we just took out all of the, you know, setting information, et cetera. And when we stripped all the way down, we found there were inconsistencies of language, inconsistencies around some of the way different things worked or didn't work. So, for example, there's no real mechanism for flaws. Now we have an idea called hindrances, which is the reverse of a flaw. So in an augment, another ability helps, or another player helps you do something and you get a bonus. And you get to use one of those. It needs to be fresh or interesting. With hindrances, a hindrance basically is a flaw, and it effectively is the opposite. It provides a hindrance to you doing that thing. So you can use a flaw as a hindrance, which is like a -5 or a -10. And we give you an experience point for reminding us that you have basically a hindrance, in the same way we also give you an experience point for fighting a role.
Yeah, it helps you lean into role-playing your character.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now, masteries are obviously on a 20-sided dice. If my ability goes beyond 20, what do I do, right? Because if I keep incrementing it, or because I have modifiers that the GM gives me to reward my brilliant tactical thinking or whatever, my number might go above 20. What do I do? So what we do is we say for every 20, you get a success, and then you roll against the remainder. So if I had 27, I get a success, and then I roll against a 7. So I might roll a 7 and get a big success. I'd have 3 successes. I might roll a 6, get an ordinary success, and have 2 successes. Or I might fail, in theory, roll a 9, but actually I'd have 1 success, because the mastery means I'm always going to have a success, right? So that mechanically, it's the same as some previous versions of HeroQuest and HeroWars. There was this chart where effectively you looked up your results, and then you did a thing called bumping, which was move the results.
It was a bit counterintuitive to have like a narrative system force you to look at charts.
Yeah, and this is just a lot easier. It produces the same outcomes, but the process is easier. So the degrees are effectively mapped to the old sort of box of charts of where you moved around, but you just do it in your head. How many successes have I got? How many do you get? What's the difference?
Yeah. The new way is just a reformulation of the same thing.
It is. It's just we just figured out a simpler way of doing it.
No, it's definitely way better. Mm-hmm. Talking about like the traits, like your flaws and your abilities and all that. One thing to note is that Westworld doesn't. I mean, genre packs might have some predefined keywords, like, you know, if you play in Glorantha, you might have some keywords for being a Sauterite or a Praxian, stuff like that. But there's no, you know, buffet of, you know, there's no skill list or something like that. So your abilities can be something more freeform, like I hate the king, or I'm funny, or something like that, right?
So in theory, you can make up any ability that you need in game that represents your character. What a genre pack is. What's a genre pack, right? So a genre pack. So Questworld's model is emulation of a genre. So the rule is, there's a couple of important rules that things could come with that, right? One is what we call a credibility test. So the question of, does this ability that I've written a name of, like I hate the king, does it let me do this, right, thing that I want to do, right? Does it basically give me a bonus to overcoming these guards because they're going to arrest me as a rebel or whatever, right? So the question we always ask is, in genre, in the kind of genre we're playing, is that true? And that means you can very easily run a pickup game for a genre that everyone at the table gets. So Star Wars is a good example, right? A lot of people run Star Wars games as a pickup game because, while there are some people who've never watched Star Wars, most gamers will have done. And you can essentially, you know, usually say, okay, I'm going to be a cynical Jedi or whatever, right? Our recommendation is you take 2 beginning abilities. One is a distinguishing characteristic, which is mainly an adjective that describes mainly your personality. And one is an occupational keyword, something that describes what you do. And this is what we call the character concept. So you could have something like, you know, scoundrel smuggler, right, for Han Solo, right? Or you could have a naive farm boy for Luke or whatever, right? And that's essentially your kind of abilities. And we might all agree, we know what a farm boy can do in Star Wars, so we wouldn't need to do anything more than that. If it's a genre where we feel it could help to explain the kind of things farm boys know how to do and get up to, you could have a description for the keyword, which textually says, oh, farm boys in the Star Wars universe can drive speeders and fix moisture evaporators and whatever, you know, we think basically a typical farm boy could do. And that may help.
Yeah.
So something like Glorantha, you obviously need a little bit more of a keyword because, well, I need to understand what someone who has this could do, right? And on top of that, we have incredible powers, which are where in that genre, there are incredible things people can do. And we have to talk about what is credible and not credible to do with those powers. And so if I've got superpowers, you know, what is my superpower? If I say I can fly, but what's credible about for me to do when I fly? Can I fly to the sun? Can I just fly around the, you know, like a bird. What is credible? And that's the credibility test, which is quite important to how we think about games. So genre packs tend to be things that define some keywords, incredible powers, and generally help you understand what is credible in that genre today.
Right. An interesting thing that utterly confused me when I first came across it in my old simulationist days was that you could actually create your character by writing a paragraph description of it and just like transform the important parts of it in keywords. So for example, you would say, I am a jaded space smuggler who runs away from his debts by flying recklessly his spaceship and getting into trouble with his blaster.
And his sidekick, the Wookiee Chewbacca, because we have
exactly. And so you would say my occupation keyword is a smuggler. I'm jaded. My flow is I've got debt with Jabba the Hutt, but I'm also good at flying and at firing my blaster. And so you would just underline. Yeah. Exactly. So, and that was a very interesting and fairly innovative.
Yeah, so underwords are still there. I'd recommend new people do what we call as you go, and that's just produce the concept, and then you have a pool of what we call ability slots, which is you basically have, if you've done the first two, you've got 10 more, you have 12, but you've already done the character concepts, given you two. And then you have what we call 20 improvement points, which you can put into stuff. And generally speaking, if you do the prose narrative, it's harder. You may end up with more abilities. You may end up with more than those 12 abilities at the beginning of the game. That's okay. We're not particularly worried about that. Everyone should be kind of using that mechanism or whatever if they want to. One of the ideas was, in theory, you could, if you wanted to create a fictional character, you could go to the book, you could lift out various sentences and paragraphs to get 100 words of description, underline stuff, and say, oh, look, you know, that's how you represent this character. So that's a neat idea, right?
So before we look into the history of Westworld, because there's a lot of cool stuff in there, for people who still are a bit maybe confused about what Questworld is or how it plays in practice, like, can you compare it to a few other games like, you know, sure, Fate or something, and talk a bit about how it plays in practice, especially as opposed to RuneQuest?
Yeah, I mean, so it falls into the family of things that we would think of as, I think I tend to use Greg's term now, storytelling games, which he first put in Prince Valiant. There are various academic terms like, you know, simulationist, narrativist. I don't think they're particularly helpful. I think that they're great if you want to go and have a theory conversation, but I don't think they're that useful to casual role players.
You're on the God Learner podcast. Of course we want to have theoretical
Yeah, the idea is the focus is on emulating a genre in the area. And a little bit, we encourage player creativity, et cetera. They tend to be non-lethal in the sense that death is a story decision that the player and the GM would come to, that life was on the line in this contest, that kind of thing. So whereas BRP aims for quite gritty realism.
Yeah. You can have unintended deaths.
Something like Questworld aims much more to emulate kind of action genre stories, etc. So it falls into the family of probably indie games that you would see in Powered by the Apocalypse games, Apocalypse World, Monster Hearts, that family of games, and then also in the Forge in the Dark set of games like Blade in the Dark, right? And those effectively. And Fate as well probably falls into the same bucket overall as kind of Fate. So it wouldn't harm me to think about those. There's an interesting, if you look at what, is it Darrington Press, who are the Critical Role outfit, they're coming out with two games, right? Daggerheart and Illuminated Worlds. And Daggerheart is effectively they describe it as their long-term campaign game, which is really their kind of BRP. And Illuminated Worlds is their kind of more, hey, you play a campaign, typically it's got 6 to 8 episodes, and maybe you stop, play another one later with the same character, you want to see that story. That's Illuminated Worlds. And I think that's a reasonable sort of model where you'd see BRP as Chaos Sims, much, you know, longer term campaign game, whereas this shorter term, hey, we're going to play 6 to 8 episodes of a game and have fun doing it, maybe come back, do a second season with the same characters. That's much more Quest Worlds. It's faster, looser, and not really, it doesn't focus on the gritty in quite the same way.
One thing that Quest World does better by virtue of resolving all things the same, which is very different from RuneQuest, where like combat is the big thing, is that it makes you feel like, for example, dramatic court scenes or other social situations are just as dramatic as action scenes.
Right, yeah.
To me, that's the main difference, really.
Yeah, and that is probably a reasonable description of a lot of indie games, is that mechanically they began to move away from the mechanics really being focused on a wargaming background, right, on essentially combat. And you know, D&D originally was based on, you know, I'm going to play my chainmail war game character. They are much more focused on the Let's Pretend story tradition, and you can resolve any action with a roll or in a short contest if you have the ability. So yeah, typically, you know, Quest Worlds is quite famous for the whole thing of, you know, let's settle this whole thing with a dance off. That's perfectly valid, right? You can do, and our mechanics will cover you doing that, right? And you can do that dance off blow by blow if that's important to you, right? You can call out your different move and make a roll for it. And so it's designed to give you tools to resolve any conflict, not just ones that basically involve violence.
So one thing I got introduced to was using Quest Worlds or related system for economic simulation.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was a game by Greg where we all played one tribe of a troll region. And we had to keep our people alive to go for the big goal, which was to feed our troll mistress to give birth to a special troll.
Interesting, yeah.
And basically, various people of the tribe were each one skill which we had to roll.
So was it like a sort of King of Dragon Pass thing where you were managing your tribe and time was passing? Yeah,
sort of. Imagine I had the bat winged trolls, and we lived by breeding moths, which did the digging for us in the Blue Moon Plateau. And we had to find some weird artifact for our queen. And I sent my maggots for digging out into the field while the tribal priestess did all the magic to keep the tribe fed.
That sounds awesome. And that, I guess, that also illustrates how, like, you would need to actually come up with special mechanics and subsystems in a game like BRP to model that, but...
Yeah,
with something like West Worlds, it's always just like an ability that you come up with against a D20, and that's it.
You had the challenge, come up with three successes for feeding the tribe, and that's what we did.
Yeah, one of the goals is definitely to simplify that process of don't add additional mechanics, right? Once the players have learned the core mechanics, that's all we need to resolve any situation. So one of the things we try and talk about in the new rule book, we give a lot of examples of how you use the rules. So we follow the Chaosium tradition of having a running example. We actually have, so in some way, you know, for RuneQuest players, be familiar with kind of Rurik from RuneQuest book or Bichurim Varosh from Cult of Prax. We follow that example. We have four different groups. And one of the things we're trying to show is different ways of interpreting the rules. And that relates, we have four different settings. There's actually another one thrown in there as well. The depth on those settings will actually come later. There's a second book which will give you three key settings. We may actually produce one of the settings from the first book, Quest Worlds. There's one called Ouvragen, which is a kind of Zarpunk, which is basically steampunk with a Russian flavor. That'll come out quite early, and then we'll get the next book, Worlds on Quest, that has these a fantasy setting, a superhero setting, and a science fiction setting, so as an example of how you do genre packs, with some discussion about what we're doing and why when we set these things up. And the idea is to really give people the tools they need so they can go away and generate a lot of their own genre packs. But yeah, no, you do. I think the you know, one of the big advantages, you can have some really dramatic moments which are focused on, you know, non-combat things which people remember as well from the game. So, you know, typically, you know, debates where I remember when I was running the Coming Storm, well, the 11 Lights campaign, basically for one of my playtest groups, and they you know, they knew that the Colbria had raised the tribal standard and thrown the Lunars out of their part of Sartar, and the Colbria were beginning to influence some of the tribes who'd left and gone to the Cincina to say, come back to us, we're now independent. Things in the story. And my player said, well, the only way we can compete with them is if we persuade the tribe that we must also raise our banners and expel the empire from within our tribal lands. And I was like, well, it's never going to happen. But we had a contest, right? We had a contest with they were speaking, at that time they were quite mover and shakery at the tribal council. And, you know, by a succession of really great roles on their part and terrible roles on my part, the outcome of the sequence was the Cincina shall rise in rebellion, right? And we had to play that out. But that's usually one of the things I think that you have to kind of really focus on with these kind of storytelling games a lot more is that because effectively you play out a whole conflict in one role sometimes, you have to be prepared for the story to pivot in entirely new directions that you weren't expecting, right? And it's this idea of saying, well, we don't want failure, you losing the contest, to be seen as bad. We want it to be seen as, hey, the story now goes in this direction. And that tends to mean we focus a lot more when you're writing a adventure on establishing an initial situation, typically people in conflict or whatever that the players are inserted into. But you much more need to, rather than have a preset, oh, they'll do this and then they'll do that and they do this, it's much more, okay, figure out what happens as the players go through. Maybe you've got some jotted ideas that say possibly they could do this and possibly they could do that, but you really have to be much more reactive. And overall, I think that's a useful point to make to folks who are wondering, oh, should I play this game or not? There's definitely a higher load on both GM to improvise in the sense of the structure of an adventure, and there's also a load on players because, you know, you need to improvise what am I going to do in this situation slightly more. You don't really have the fallback of saying, oh, I know at some point in tonight's session there'll probably be a combat and I've got all my abilities written down and I can basically play tonight because I've had a really tough day at work, I'm tired. I just won't say very much, and I'll roll the dice when it comes to my, you know, to combat, and I'll have fun that way. Most of the kind of indie storytelling games tend to require you to participate and help move the story along together, and we want you to help us drive the story and pick the direction that things are going. But that requires, you know, involvement. And for folks who are shy and really just want to play their guy and roll his numbers, it's not an ideal game, right? For folks that love to choose scenery and want to try and take control of the story and not have, you know, the GM dictate to them, it's a fantastic tool. Mm-hmm.
There's also sort of the extra barrier of jumping from a simulation system to a narrative system. I know there's like two things that help me click on narrative systems, and I can share them afterwards, but like, what would be your way to explain narrative systems or storytelling games?
Yeah, storytelling games, you tend to want to be about something. So we have these ideas like narrative hook in Quest Worlds, which says, what is my character's goal? What do they want to do, right? Why have they decided the life of a mild-mannered accountant is not for them, but actually they want to seek a life of adventure or whatever, right? And so some of it is you focus as much on that, playing through what your character's story is, or effectively the GM presents something to you and you're trying to think in story terms and say, okay, what if there's a story we would turn together? What kind of thing would I want to do here? And also another player may come up with something and you may think, oh, I could really help his or her story by jumping in at this point and doing something for them, right? So I think much more it's focused on the idea that you are collectively telling a story and using the dice to resolve uncertainty and produce branches in the narrative. Much more than it's a war game with a kind of story attached to it, right? That, which is, I don't mean that pejoratively, but the idea of saying I have a set of abilities which will help me overcome kind of obstacles on a map and fight and defeat foes and that kind of thing. And any story is, if you like, accidental. It's the account of our events that occurred, but that's the story. Whereas in these games, you're focused on trying to generate a story.
Quest Wars is now the third name of this game.
It is, yeah.
So, let's look a bit why is it no longer HeroQuest, and what is HeroQuest, and how did it start?
Yeah, so back in when Chaosium had a great diaspora in the 90s following ill-advised problems with collectible card games, as they were called at the time. And various of the principals, as they left, took bits of it with them. So while Chaosium focused on Cthulhu, Greg took his Garantha staff away, Pendragon went somewhere else entirely, etc. So Greg still had Garantha. He was focused much more in a developing the background of the world, his unfinished works, King of Sarta kind of thing. And then towards the turn of the millennium, decided he wanted a new game. And if you'd seen sort of Greg's progression as a game designer, right, Pendragon, Prince Valiant, I mean, even at the point of Ghostbusters, he'd moved in for a lot of role-playing to look at that kind of era of gaming. And he commissioned Robin Laws to write a much more, if you like, storytelling-focused game for Garantha. That was called Hero Wars. So, interestingly enough, one of the goals was, so I presume most of your fans will know, but there are a couple of unpublished Garantha novels. One is called, basically, All Men Should Know This, and the other is 10 Women Well Loved, which came later. And some of you maybe even have obtained a thing called Garantha Visions. I don't know if it's elsewhere, called Morden Defends the Camp, which is an extract from All Men Should Know This. All Men Should Know This is focused on the story of Harmast, Ten Women Loved in the First Age, right? All Men Should Know This is basically the beginning of where Harmast kind of comes from. And what Greg and Robin wanted to do was create a system which could emulate Greg's stories. So when they took an exception like Morden Defends the Camp, they were saying, okay, how do we play something that looks like this, right? And, you could put a RuneQuest hat on and you could look at Morden Defends the Camp and you could interpret this as, well, it's just another name for a rune spell that Morden's using, that kind of thing. But Greg, I think, wanted to be more flexible. He wanted to let people come up with names and say, okay, I'm going to do my X rune magic, right? And the same way Morden has all these little names that represent kind of mythical things that he's drawing on the power of. And so they created this game to help you essentially provide a storytelling game which let you tell stories in the same way as Greg's unpublished stories. And perhaps, unfortunately, although they created Garantha Visions and the idea was to have more Garantha fiction, and so you could read Garantha stories and play them using Hero Wars, the fiction side never really took off. And so a little bit, it was left without that backing of, well, I can read the story that I'm actually emulating in Hero Wars. Hero Wars has also rushed out. I mean, Greg missed out on the chance to create Kickstarter, really, because he created a thing called the Garantha Trading Association, where we all said, Greg will produce a book and we'll put our money for that. If only we'd known and said to Greg, yeah, forget Garantha, let's create Kickstarter. You'll be rich, Greg. So that was the first question, and it was a bit rushed. I mean, essentially, all the fans, we chipped in money for it to happen, and it came out a bit rushed. The problem a bit for Hero Wars when it first came out, though, is it was a shock, I think, to many Garantha fans. Yes. Because a lot of them had been very much in the BRP space, and they hadn't really seen where game design was going. And Robin Laws, of course, game design, professional game designer, much more invested in where is game design going. And so a storytelling system, you know, this is post, you know, Vampire the Masquerade in the 90s when things moved away from this kind of, you know, classic dungeon crawling model to people wanted to tell stories. As a storytelling system, you know, it was great. But for a lot of people, it's kind of like, whoa, what happened? Also, the other thing was it was very much based on the 90s work that Greg was doing around Garantha. And that complicated things a little bit for people because Greg had moved much more to this kind of pantheon model rather than a global pantheon, the Godlander view. He kind of stepped away from the Godlander view and said, let's have a very local view. So you'll have these weird names for some of the gods that request players to go, who's that? Right. And of course, what Greg's saying is that's not, no, I'm going to use the local name because we're going to put this genre pack from a Star Trek perspective. That's what people call. And that also, I think, threw Grantha fans because it was a bit like, I need to now map from my God Learner model to this localized model that Greg's now embraced.
Yeah.
But interestingly enough, outside of that community, there was a very influential game design community called The Forge. The Forge is where the people that create Powered by the Apocalypse, people that create basically Blades in the Dark, they are all there along with someone called, I can't remember who started it, but Ron Edwards is one of the main figures. I don't think he started it. And Clinton Nixon is basically one of the people that helps administer the site. And there's a lot of discussion about storytelling games, and it's partially because the self-publishing, the growth of the internet, electronic file formats mean it's much more viable for anyone to become a publisher now, right? The distribution problem is broken a bit. And so they start this very independent punkish movement develops this kind of like punk, you know, DIY ethos. And they embrace Greg's system because it's seen as basically creator-owned and controlled. And it became very influential. It had its own forum at the Forge. It's influenced a whole lot of stuff that came later. So the Shadows of Yesterday, which Clinton Nixon had, was almost like a love letter to it. And there was definitely a huge influence on indie game, unseen, I think, by most of the Grantham community from RuneQuest. But we had some people who came into our community and, you know, were talking in forums, etc., that went on to do other significant things. It did okay enough, but then Greg basically was able to get Isseries to launch a new version. And one of the interesting things that happened, although he called it Hero Wars, Milton Bradley had let the HeroQuest trademark, which they'd taken for the game, lapse. There's a very long story about HeroQuest was always supposed to be the successor game to RuneQuest. Games Workshop or someone had taken HeroQuest, or Milton Bradley had taken HeroQuest and used it for their board game. They had the board game was out of print. The trademark elapsed. Greg grabbed it and then produced the game under HeroQuest, which caused endless confusion because lots of people, you say to them, oh, I ran a con game. And someone said, I'm here to play HeroQuest, the board game. And we're like, no, we're playing HeroQuest, the role-playing game. And she was brilliant. Yes. She just got into it and was one of the best player in the whole game. But it caused some confusion. Hero Wars is basically Robin Laws and Greg. But HeroQuest is very much Greg, right? Greg, helped by people like Mark Galeotti, Merlin Cox, things like that. But it's very much Greg takes the system and writes a new very much role playing game, very much him. The sections around, you know, landscape deities and spirits, effectively, I know he was very happy with what he'd written there, etc., those kind of things. What I think is very interesting about HeroQuest is Greg very much wanted to encourage this idea of your Grantha will vary, and it's really kind of one of the places where it started, because I think some of the reaction to Hero Wars was, what is this, right? And Greg was like, I want to encourage that. So in the examples in the HeroQuest book, his players do what the kind of players Greg was used to at a table tend to do, right? So somebody says, he says to somebody, because it's a storytelling game and you're making up abilities, he says, okay, what kind of magic do you do, right? And this person says, I fold origami shapes and I use them to make spells, right? And Greg's like, okay, great. I don't know what that is yet. I don't know what that is in Glorantha, but that's what you do, right? And later he decides, okay, it's probably a form of sorcery, and your book of origami pans is your book of spells, and this is just materially how you do it. Somebody else says, you know, I want to be a puma person. I can change into a puma shape, right? Greg says, well, we've not heard of puma people in Glorantha, right? They haven't existed before. So you're the last of a dying race. Right. And that what he's trying to show you is how you use Glorantha. You know, famously in his RuneQuest campaign, we had Redbird, who was a D&D character who was placed in the RuneQuest game. Greg said never again. And he was doing, and he had basically D&D magic in Glorantha, right? So Greg was very much, you know, when you're playing a game, you are playing something collectively, and it can be as crazy as you collectively decide, right? He was never, when you played with him, never one of those people that said, you know, we are going to play a game where canon and trying to live in the world is our master. He was always like, how are we going to have fun? One of the characters in the example characters learns how to surf, right? And that was very much Greg and his take on Glorantha, right? Glorantha was a thing that you, the point was to have a great, I think I remember him once saying, basically, don't you people actually have a laugh, right? And I think that was one of his big things, was the idea was that you should, you could run with stuff and make things fun. So a little bit, it moved away from, if you like, the model that RuneQuest had had, where it was all about, hey, here's this cult description. This is what it'd be like to live in a cult. Here's this heavy description of what it's like to be a Sartorite, right? And was much looser, right? So you had a homeland spread, two pages, which described, hey, you live in this world. And cult write-ups were reasonably short. You know, here's a few things you need to know. And the idea was to really encourage you to make a lot of that up, right? And it's the great secret of Glorantha, right? Which outside Dragon Pass, we know virtually nothing, right? So make it up, right? And the advantage of that game is if you take, I felt liberated. Some people, you have two reactions, right? I felt liberated by Hero Wars and HeroQuest because what it said to me is, here's this great set of ideas, Glorantha, you can make up and do whatever you want at the table with your friends and tell different types of Glorantha stories, right? So I, you know, I went and the guide's really fantastic for that because you get a copy of the guide, tells you enough detail about anywhere. And I went and ran a game in Rallyos. Why not? I ran a game where basically, you know, we were also, everybody had, was a member of a different Arcati secret society. So they all had the objectives in the game, but they also had, a bit like Paranoid, they all had their own little secret society they're a member of, et cetera. And you can just do crazy things like that. So I think that was, I think Hero Quest first edition was a fantastic vision by Greg of how you could use Glorantha as a chaosium, as a chaotic well of material that you could pull upon, but really wanted you to create stuff in your game that you felt was basically how Glorantha would work for you. And so in a sense, it moves away from the first book, which says emulate the novels, to this other one, which says essentially, no, just create Glorantha for yourselves. And here is permission. And I think people misunderstood some of the stuff like Puma people. Like, you know, people were like, well, why is Greg introduced Puma people now in suddenly in the Glorantha? They're silly. And it's like, but they're
it's canon now. It was in the sidebar.
Yeah. But it's actually this player wanted to play a Puma person. That's all it's for, right? So it's the idea of, because we all have real players, right? We all have real players who, and they're not necessarily always as into Glorantha as we are, right? And you say, okay, we're going to run a game in Glorantha, right? And then they say, great, what are we? And you say, you're Sartorites. And you say, what's that like? And you go, well, they're bronze. And then someone goes, really? And you just go, okay, Celts, Vikings, whatever, something like that, right? Because ultimately, if they're not really into it, you got to come up with shorthands. And some of the players will say stuff to you like, I want to play, you know, I want to play a dude who's, I have one basically who said he's an assassin, right? He's an assassin, and he said my stick for this character is going to be that only two people are allowed to know his real identity, and he has to kill anyone beyond that, or he has to keep it at two. He has to kill them. So we just made him a humacti. We made him a humacti who had these geases that basically said no more than two people may know you know, that you're anything other than just a charcoal stick picker. And we had this whole thing where he was also geared that if you basically paid him 30 pieces of silver, he had to kill whoever you told him basically you wanted killed. So that's how he served his God, right? And he was a fantastic character. Brilliant. But it's not the kind of thing that we'd have got out of a much stricter Glorantha, right? We said, okay, yeah, how can we use Glorantha to make your idea possible in this game, right? Yeah.
And then usually you can start branching out a bit, saying that, oh, well, maybe there's other humanities like that. And
yeah.
And there's like there's other lost Puma people and et cetera, et cetera. But
so, yeah. So exactly. So you may hit part of the story he may wanted to tell is, you know, I find the Humacti assassins kind of like training temple in the high mountains as part of my story, right? Definitely a thing I want to find where they all are, and I can train and get, you know, better Humacti assassin abilities, right? And sure, right? You know, I think I played a game in Notchet once with Greg, and it's an interesting thing, right? You play with Greg at a con, and he basically said at the beginning of the game, right, I don't know a lot about Notchet. So why don't everybody makes up one fact about Notchet, right? So I made up this fact. I think it's the first occurrence of it, which basically is, oh, the Ezrolian matriarchs have incredibly elaborate hairstyles. I've been watching Rome, I think, and all characters have, like, you know, have these great wigs, right? So they all have wigs and incredibly elaborate hairstyles. So that filtered in. I think that ended up, Greg put it in a book later, right? Hairstyles in Notchet, right? Where did that come from? We just made it up at a table, right? That's where a lot of stuff comes from, right? But he would make stuff up, right? He was just describing a truth spell, and we were being interviewed by the matriarchs, and described it basically because my character's male as I feel like an invisible hand is effectively crushing around your balls, and when you want to tell a lie, you know, it really begins to hurt, right? And the thing I liked about that is Greg focused on the effect of the magic, the story. He didn't feel it has to conform to these rules. It's just an ability that you've got that fits our conception of how magic might work in Glorantha, right? But I don't have to really explain, oh, she's using the detect truth spell here. He just described the effect, right? And that was very much, I think, liberating for Greg as well, was describe the effect of the magic. You don't necessarily have to account for mechanically what this is going to do in game, because it's that feel you want. And I think you felt quite liberated by that.
And I think that participates in my feeling that Glorantha played in HeroQuest Quest Worlds feels more magical than Glorantha played in RuneQuest, because in RuneQuest it's almost like scientific. It's like, is it a blade sharp one or two, or is it a detective truth or whatever? Whereas in Quest World or HeroQuest, it's just like you rolled and you said like, oh, and there's a spirit and there's a whatever. It's just like an effect. There's more flavor.
Yeah, exactly. So here at the first edition, I've got no idea what numbers are. One of the Chaosium principles has probably got numbers somewhere. But my anecdotal evidence would be that it was pretty successful. Talked about a lot on various forums. It was probably quite a high point for that system. But as we learned more about that kind of game, not just within our community and broader community, I think there's a couple of things that people felt. One is that HeroQuest First Edition still had some holdovers, really, from more that kind of war gamey sort of style that we could probably jettison. There were areas where there were rules that, I mean, in the first Hero Wars, there'd been rules about edges and handicaps, which were to do with representing weapons and equipment, right? Which is really kind of unnecessary.
Jörg was mentioning them before the recording. He mentioned them, saying like those were weird.
Yeah. So I think there was an attempt then to strip the last parts of that out, right? And then that led to HeroQuest second edition. So Robin came back at that point, looked at some of the things people complained about the system, and produced a new edition. And that came out first as a generic system. So saying, actually, this could be done beyond Eric's of Glorantha. And then basically there was Jeff Richard, David Scott, Neil Robinson, others basically then created a new Grant and
the Hero Quest Glorantha.
Interestingly enough, I think you can see in that some of the DNA that later goes over to RuneQuest, beginning to form for those authors in Hero Quest Glorantha. And so there we were. It was definitely a slightly more RuneQuest feel than Hero Quest First Edition had been. You know, long form cult descriptions, etc.
Yeah, and even followed by like the Sartar Kingdom book and the Sartar Companion, which like basically when you were saying earlier that HeroQuest First Edition was like short description that leave you a lot of freedom. Here it was a more like, you know, here's 300 pages about exactly what Sartar is.
I mean, Jeff particularly was very prolific in that period, right? We essentially had somebody who was able to full-time work on Grant the material, with the culmination being the guide. You can see Jeff trying out various ideas that essentially he revisits more fully in RuneQuest.
Yeah. What was Greg's take on that HeroQuest Glorantha period? Because if you say he was more into like the short form that give you freedom, what was his take on that second line?
I think that Jeff felt that I don't want to speak for Jeff. That's always a worrying thing to do. My memory roughly is that people felt that some of the RuneQuest fans still felt left behind, and they wanted to produce a Glorantha version of HeroQuest that would make that they would be more comfortable with, and they would basically be able to feel brought back into the fold in terms of the setting material. It was a bit, you know, a bit less gonzo perhaps than HeroQuest First Edition had been, right?
What about you, Jörg? Like, because you were around at that time, so what was the, you know, the feeling on the ground, so to speak, about like Hero Wars, HeroQuest, HeroQuest Glorantha?
Well, I was sort of a keeper of canon, even in the HeroQuest 1 period, which led me to some indirect cooperation with Ian for the Dragon Pass Gazetteer, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was focused on producing the cohesive background at the time.
Yeah.
But I felt that HeroQuest 1 actually supported that, and stuff like Men of the Sea was brilliant for exploring all of Glorantha.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I mean, Glorantha has different takes over time, right? So there's a, you know, Hero Wars has a certain group of writers who are the dominant voices, right? And so we get, you know, Thunder Rebels, Hero Wars, right? Which I definitely quite like, right? I don't think they're bad. I think they're just that group of writers' vision, right? And Greg had always seen Glorantha as somewhere where he could work with a group of writers who would tell stories set in his world. That for him was definitely part of what he wanted to achieve. And so that's one group of writers, and they have a certain vision. HeroQuest First Edition is a different group of writers, right? I get more involved probably at that point with, you know, people like Mark Galliotti, Simon Bray, others, in fact, Martin Hawley, Jörg and I, basically. So we with Greg and a whole host of authors, we wrote the Dragon Pass Gazetteer, and that was a little bit of a mix of, hey, some of these fans have written a lot of interesting stuff around this area, let's get that together. Yep. And then there's the next era, which is kind of like the Jeff, you know, Neil, David Scott, et cetera, that kind of era. Simon Bray and I traveled through those kind of eras, right? Yeah. You know, Grant is like any fictional property, it will take on characteristics of the stories the writers of that time find most interesting and want to tell. So it's a little bit, you know, to say there is a given Glorantha, I think there are given versions of Glorantha at given points in time. I think there's the, you know, the, even I would point to say the Ken Rolston RuneQuest Renaissance period, right? If you look at River of Cradles and some of the great adventures in that, right? The, I can't remember what it's called, where you effectively journey up the river and you become friends of the river and that kind of thing, etc. That's a great campaign. It's a bit different to say the Borderlands era of early Chaosium, kind of almost a Steve Perrin kind of era, right? So I think the thing is, they're all, I think of them all as equally valid. They're just different viewpoints. And if you get a different group of writers working with, inspired by something, you're going to get a different set of ideas, right? And that's great. I think that's perfectly great. But what I think we should all take from that is when we run our own games, we are just like those groups of writers, creating something that is shaped by our preferences and influences and interests, and our players' influences and interests at the table. And our game will, that's why your Grand Theft will vary, will be shaped differently. And your Grand Theft will vary applied, really, if you like, to the various clusters of writers at different times writing for Grand Theft, right? Which is why, you know, canon is a bit weird, right? Because saying canon should apply across back to the beginning of time is a bit crazy, because it's different groups of people with a different perspective, right? It, you know, canon really could only last for the, it only be really focused on the current set of writers and what they want to produce, right, any one time.
Right. And is that exactly why we end up with having basically RuneQuest now as the main Glorantin game, even though it sounds to me like Greg was more into more storytelling games like HeroQuest? Like if Greg was in charge, we would be all playing HeroQuest and Glorantin?
Hard to say, right? I mean, I think it's much more complicated than that. I don't think you could predict what would happen. I mean, Greg was there when RuneQuest was produced, right? Greg produced Pendragon from out of RuneQuest, etc. Mm-hmm. But beyond speculation, I think the easiest thing to understand is right now we have a current group of writers who are writing Grand Theft. It is their Grand Theft, and that is great, right? And it's not about this one better than that one or anything like that.
Oh, yeah,
It's just they were different visions at different times. And, you know, you can really say HeroQuest First Edition is the vision that Greg had for Glorantha with that group of writers at that time. And there's this whole notion of, you know, Greg being an Arcati and constantly changing. But also he was, in a lot of this Glorantha stuff, quite a great collaborator. So a lot of the time he's bouncing off the people who are working with him at that time, and it's a shared vision, right?
Yeah.
So that changes because there's the collaborators he's got change. The nature that the shared vision will obviously change, right? So I had my heyday in one particular or a couple of eras. I mean, I span actually Hero Wars and both versions of HeroQuest, but probably a lot of influence in HeroQuest Glorantha, and some influence basically for the kind of HeroQuest First Edition.
Well, speaking of your heyday, let's talk about these things a bit.
Okay.
About the two books that you mentioned earlier, your 11 Lights campaign, which is a HeroQuest Glorantha campaign about the Red Cow clan within the Cincina or Cincina tribe, as Jeff says, apparently.
I say Cincina, right?
Yeah, I say Cincina too, but anyway.
the only way I've been able to divine it, what it might have been once upon a time, is a spelling mistake from one of his players that suggests they were pronouncing it with an S, but maybe they were wrong too, so who knows?
So can you tell a bit more about how that campaign came about, and can you maybe mention a few things about the ever elusive third volume?
So when I was writing the Dragon Pass Gazetteer, I actually became very interested in the Cincina. The Colimar was essentially the most famous because they were the ones Greg had set his games in and the ones that King of Sartar focused on. And I decided, actually, when I look at this tribe, it's really interesting. They are located, if you like, towards the frontiers with the Far Place. They are bordered by the Telmori, and they've obviously had this existential struggle with the Telmori werewolves. They're kind of like locked into part of Johnstown as well, and that seems like quite an interesting location. And particularly the story of the conflict with the Telmori, I saw as quite interesting. So for my home game, I said, well, let's tell the story. Let's tell the story, basically, of the Cincina and the Telmori, and let's start it just before, really early on, just after the Lunar Invasion and before, effectively, the Telmori destroyed the Mabota. So there was also one of the Grantham visions was a Johnny Boyle novel, The Road of Kings, which you can get on Amazon with all the Grantham serial numbers filed off and weird things like Babylon and Sumo, and it's obviously Grantham because it's like, and it hasn't the geography of anything. So you can find a Grantham novel out there that's got the serial numbers filed off by Johnny Boyle. But the Road of Kings story was quite interesting. And it also had him being a kind of like male descendant of the Mabota line, right? And oh, that's a really interesting story. So I wrote a thing called The Book of Red Cow, which I think might still be available for the Well of Deliath or something like that, which was effectively a clan description for the Red Cow clan. And my players played through the year before, basically, the Mboda were wiped out. And kind of played into what happened. And we learned what happened, right? I didn't know what happened. We kind of learned what happened in our game, which actually, as they started, there's a passing reference in Thunder Rebels to a feud with the Split Waters clan from the Red Cow. So I picked up on that. They were fighting a feud, you know, classic, very Irish and Viking and Icelandic influence. That was the flavor of the day at the time. And when we were creating, there was a big influence at that time around Grantha. And so they were all ended up being exiled as a result. So I said, oh, that's interesting. I wonder what they all do. Some of these exiles from both of these clans, they actually go into this disputed area that doesn't really seem to belong to either the Cincina or the Talmora and start settling there. And I decided this is an area, like a buffer area, where they basically said it's hunting land, no one may settle there. And Mboda effectively sponsored this expedition. I decided that was the cause of what happened. We played out that game. And then my players wanted to, you know, pick up with them. But I didn't really want to play through all of the years of the occupation. So I decided it would be more interesting to jump to the other bit when we lead up to basically the liberation. So I said, okay, well, let's play every, you know, 10 years later or whatever. Let's start in 1617. And some of your player characters will now be NPCs, movers and shakers in the campaign. So some of them are actually in the Coming Storm book. And we'll play a game which will take us from 1617 to 25. And I was very, you know, I mean, it sounds woefully overambitious and arrogant. I've also quite influenced by the Boy King. And I thought I like the idea of having historical events in a given year and you playing through how you react to known histories. That's kind of a setting. And then I built everything I needed to do that. And then I kind of said, oh, I was doing it, I thought, well, hang on a minute. Everybody probably needs some of this stuff, right? Lots of people don't have the time and they may want to run the classic or anti-clan game set in Sartar. So this could be worth publishing because that gives everybody a fully fleshed out clan with its personalities, etc., plus a campaign you can use with them. And this was occurring in this sort of transition between HeroQuest First Edition to HeroQuest Second Edition. I then got quite involved with Jeff because it turned out, you know, in order to basically build HeroQuest's new edition, we were going to need to have keywords for Sartarites, kind of for that edition. We were going to need to update the clan generator that had appeared in Orant is Dead. So I did a lot of that, which came up with, so I appeared in Sartar Kingdom of Heroes, which kind of led, pushed me further down the line. I had Johnstown originally as a part of the setting, and then that got pushed into one of the Sartar books as well. But eventually it then emerges this more slightly, you know, just focused on clan description and their neighbors, the Coming Storm. So it covers the Red Cow, but it also covers the Deleuther. That came from Simon Bray and mine Hawley, who created a grant from Freeform called The Wolf Comes Into the Cold. And I really liked some of their ideas, set during the Great Winter. So I spoke to Simon, we took some of their ideas. And then because I needed the neighbors to the south from the Colburia, who there was obviously tension with, I reached out to what was the name of the Andres press?
Tentacles Press, I think it was, yeah.
Might have been, yeah. And they had a whole load of material, basically, that Andre and Patrick and others had kind of worked on around the Colbria.
Yeah.
So we took some of those ideas. And then a little bit, Jeff Rich and I played with them, morphed them, right? Jeff was a little bit like, yeah, that's not quite right. And it, we were very much influenced at the time because Jeff was definitely leaning much more into his vision of we need to be really focused on being Bronze Age, right? There was this feeling that RuneQuest 2 had said, it's kind of late Bronze Age, early Iron Age, right? So I think actually what it technically says is material culture is Bronze Age, sociopolitical culture is early Iron Age in RuneQuest. But Jeff was saying we should double down more on this kind of Bronze Age, Iron Age feel. We should stop the creeping medievalization. So I think part of the problem with, and Greg had done it too, taking those influences from medieval Ireland or medieval Iceland as stories that interested us about barbarian peoples was the material culture had come too. So there was an idea to try and push some of that away, be cleaner about it. So some of that came in. And yeah, Jeff was quite keen at the time on the Tel Mori story being quite tragic, you know, Volsung saga almost kind of tragic. So that became quite a tragic story. So we have, I don't know necessarily, I mean, as it's not out of print, I don't think it's killing anything in the game to say. So there's this notion in Greg's writing of the fact that the Tel Mori have Sartre blood. So they do have the blood of the Sartre kings amongst certain people. So Kosajal is effectively an heir to the throne of Sartre, right? And he saves various heirs of battles, and the Tel Mori royal guard protect them because it's their bloodline, right? That's the reason they're loyal to Sartre, is that it's their bloodline. So we kind of figured out, oh, the Helkos brothers who are mentioned in King of Sartre, they are actually heirs to the throne of Sartre. So one of the things that happens in the Eleven Lights is they are killed one by one. So that by the end of it, there is no longer a Tel Mori bloodline in the House of Sartre. So that was also part of kind of what we were trying to tell in the story. And then I'd run, and someone else had run, from my Benedict Adamson had run a campaign set in the Great Winter before. And the trouble with games in the Great Winter is you say to the players, oh, Warlamp is dead, and there's nothing you can do about it. Right? Yeah. And it's just, for most players, that's kind of like, why have you created this thing that I am told I cannot do anything about? I'm a hero, right? I want to fix the problem, please.
Yeah, I can't use my magic anymore.
Yeah, so that was when we said, okay, well, what we should suggest you do is don't play too much misery. So Robin Laws always says, the Brits, we love misery adventures, because we basically says it's some, he thinks it's some, you know, institutional memory of the Blitz and our struggle, you know, in the Blitz or whatever, or being an island alone, you know, whatever. But it's a bit disappointing. So we say start much more when we are beginning to effectively react and build them back. So we created the, we worked with Greg and created the three New Lights hero quest. Although, typical Greg, he kind of scratched out a whole series of runes and it became the belts that described the hero quest. And Greg didn't say, it's exactly like this. He said, runically, here's this thing and here's my rough idea. And we turned that into an actual adventure. And that's where the three new stars came from, which was this, you know, massive hero quest where you travel across the sky to essentially birth three new stars to give or anti who follow those rites back their magic. And we, yeah, I think that was the point where we kind of came up with this idea that, you know, various groups around the world are all hero questing to free Analda and to free Orlant because they're all affected. But you have one part where you do this thing, right? But maybe there are other hero questers, like off stage for us is, you know, somebody helps free Analda so at the Battle of Iceland, she can we can get Spring back or whatever. And our assumption was probably a lot of that is happening in Notchet, right? A lot of that struggle in Notchet, it's down there, but it's not part of the story we're telling. And then what else? I also felt I really want, if you look at history and the events of what happened, there are some really amazing things that you can do for your players, like the Crimson Bat, right? So the Crimson Bat comes through Sartre. So, we're going to play through that, right? We're going to play what is it like to experience the Crimson Bat passing. And obviously, of course, the players can't kill the Crimson Bat. They're just not powerful enough. But there's a whole...
Right, no, there are stats in the RuneQuest bestiary. If it has stats, it can be killed.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you could handle that in because of the scalability of the system in your request. You certainly could have handled it, but they'd just die. But there's one where you try and free some of the people who are being held captive by the Bat cult to be, you know, sacrificed. And, you know, the assumption must be if you succeed, a few of the Bat cultists are going to have to be fed to the Bat instead in your place. So yeah, and that was basically the coming storm in the Eleven Lights, which I think suffered a little bit from so HeroQuest Grandthor, I think, suffered a little bit from, we got HeroQuest Grandthor out, we got Coming Storm and 11 Lights out, but by that point, effectively, Moon has, there have been the changes where Moon Design Publications essentially merges with Chaosium, and the, you know, there is then a possibility through, because of various stars becoming aligned, of RuneQuest then reappearing, and I think that it arrived really almost at the sunset of HeroQuest Glorantha, as interest began to pivot towards, you know, RuneQuest Glorantha being a thing. So that was, I think, a little bit of a shame for it, in the sense that probably a number of people have never seen it because they, you know, came back into the fold by the time that it was probably out of print, and, you know, now is not available at all.
Yeah, it's sad. I think your two books are one of my favorite ones, some of my top five books of the whole Glorantha line. But there's one book that nobody can get because it was never released, and that's the Volume 3 that covers the Dragon Rise. Jörg earlier was telling me that he played in a game with you at Kraken about the Batcave. So can you tell us about that Volume 3?
Yeah, I can. I'm actually playing through it again with some Grantham newbies who I met in the pandemic. And that's been really useful to me because I've got a kind of like my own document for Questworlds Grantham, which is very much what I do at the minute is write a genre pack to use the RuneQuest material. So I've got a whole document for that. And I'm what I'm using with my player. So we have rune magic and spirit magic again. And we just, you know, as like I was saying, with spirit magic, right, you just say, oh, you get tired. We don't trap magic points, all that kind of thing, because it's a much more storytelling-based system, right? So Robin Laws would say to me, you know, typically, when do people become tired of from using too much spirit magic? When the story says that it would be interesting that they become tired of using too much rune magic. But so the idea was that in the Coming Storm, you're focused on your clan and its survival. And you do participate in some great events. The three new stars, the Battle of Dangerford is kind of the big finale where the 11 lights take stage. But I also really always wanted to give people an option to play Sartorite Rebels who bring about the Dragon Rise. The interesting thing, if you read King of Sartre exactly, about the only person it's clear is on the quest is Minrith Purple, right? So you can say, was Kelly really there? Maybe she wasn't, right? So maybe it's the player characters, right? And you can fill out the roster because there's quite, you know, 11 stars, you know, 11 people. So you can fill out the roster, whichever PCs you as the GM were to decide. So what happens in the game? I still may try and get it to the Johnstown Compendium at the end of a kind of another playthrough. Mm-hmm. It may be an interesting artifact for those that are interested. I probably wouldn't do a huge amount of work to re-RuneQuestize it or whatever. But there's a scenario in 1623 where you essentially it's the Both and Spy scenario. Where effectively you penetrate the Temple of the Reaching Moon as slaves working on basically the Temple of the Reaching Moon to discover its secrets, and you discover that it is built over a dragon. Then in 2024, the next year, you do kind of the boat rise, but mainly the interest there is obviously speaking to the cosmic dragon. And in 1625, there's the Dragon Rise itself, which we've got some great notes about, and, you know, it kind of tells us effectively that there's this ceremony of the perfect star, and what happens is all answering burst into it, which, of course, you can claim is set up by the three new stars. They try to eliminate all answer so he wouldn't need to be present, sort of thing. And the idea effectively is everyone has to kind of keep to their stations apart from you, who are able to move, and you twist and turn around, and everyone else sees the heavens moving rapidly through a whole cycle. And essentially you get to the center, and if you can kind of get to the center, the idea is before essentially dawn, you effectively break their ritual. They can't create the Temple of Reaching Moon, and you will summon the dragon at that point. So we can do all that. Interestingly enough, if you look at, you know, the notes for it, I can also maybe, depending on within today, there's definitely a RuneQuest sort of like cradle style scenario in there somewhere, where effectively you get a large sort of table and you put the positions of all the various lunar priests and stat them out, and you get like little markers that show the range of spells and that kind of thing, and you show their path, and the players move around firing spells at people who have to keep station or whatever and that kind of thing. But yeah, so that's the envisaged kind of third book. There's also an envisaged fourth book. God knows if I'll ever get around to actually doing anything for that Johnstown Compendium. But I wanted to look at what causes Argrath to betray the Talmori and destroy them in about 1627, right?
Yeah, that annoys me. I like the Talmori.
So. Yeah, and we give a hint of that it's all the fault of the Red Cow. So, I mean, I can give you the pitch.
Sure. Yes, please.
There's a prophecy that Argrath must fulfill, and that's that he must hunt Aurochs again in Dragon Pass. The Red Cow, and that's in the Eleven Lights, have basically a hero quest that lets them steal the giant's cows.
Yeah.
And they cheat, right? They succeeded and they cheat, and that's what they get the Red Cow. So how do they cheat? Well, they know the location of the giant's giant steading, I guess it would be. It's G1 all over again, right? Where the giant steading is, because that's Red Cow 4. So they sneak in through some tunnels they know about, and then they effectively surprise the giants and are able to get away with the cows. But because of that, I don't think we explained that in the 11 Lights, I can't remember. But because of that, their magic is weakened.
Yeah, I think it's explained that instead of getting Aurochs, they just get red cows that are not fully Aurochs because they cheated, yeah.
So my theory is Argrath, effectively, in order to bring the Aurochs back, unites people to form a joint hero quest, which effectively smashes in the front door of the giant steading and takes the cows, and then there are Aurochs born. But in order for Argrath to participate in this, you know, secret myth that the Cincina know, they exact quite a terrible price from Argrath, which is we demand basically that the Sartorite forces destroy the Talmori.
Yeah.
And of course, because there are no members of the royal family left within Sartar's line, it isn't kin strife anymore for Argrath to do that. So, yeah, that's my thing about what happens in 1627. It's my theory there's going to be a scenario.
Yeah, I think that's a great take.
And I think those are the kind of stories I like, right, where effectively, you know, there's this terrible price. I like the idea that Argrath's constantly forced to pay terrible prices for his goal, and by the end of it, the question, a bit like Arcat, by the end of it, the question is, you know,
was it worth it?
What has he become? There's a fantastic book by William Golding called The Spire, and it's about essentially a priest who has a vision of this mighty tower rising above what is, I think, the Salisbury Cathedral, visible from Mars around, you know, all the people will be able to see it and realize the majesty of God. But he's forced to basically indulge in terrible compromises to get it built. It turns out some of the, you know, the builders, everybody else, they're not as Christian as you might want to be. They're pagan, and they still have some pagan leanings. They end up with this foundation ritual. Someone is sacrificed because it's on a Salisbury Cathedral is basically built on a kind of swamp land. So it's not stable. And they basically, the builders are all like, well, it's not going to work. So there's foundation ritual. And they build this thing at the end. It's kind of crooked and it leans kind of thing, et cetera. And the whole thing is a metaphor, if you like, for this idea of we have these visions, be they creative or artistic or whatever, and essentially we make all these compromises to birth them into reality. And, of course, the thing that's finally crooked and a bit, it's not what we imagined. And I always imagine Argrath, that kind of figure, that he's got this vision of what he's trying to do. And by the end, the compromises and everything he's been, like Arcat, that he's forced to undertake to kind of bring down the moon, make him quite a difficult figure, I think.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, we'll see if I'm a good enough GM to do that. But that's a theme I want to bring as my player characters are becoming more and more like heroes. And as they grow up and they do more and more things, I want to start introducing difficult moral choices or tactical choices and basically sort of match their rise to power. We'll see.
Yeah. So one of the things in the sort of Dragon Rise campaign, one of the ideas is which comes from the material that kind of Greg was looking at in the HeroQuest era, is you begin to experiment with dragon magic, with godlearner ideas, that kind of thing, et cetera. And you do that because these are weapons that will help you challenge the empire, right? A small, tiny, but wealthy kingdom. How are you going to take on the might of the empire? Well, maybe we should embrace dragon magic, right? And a lot of the interesting things in that game are about the putting that before the players as a choice, right? Are you going to become what? I think in HeroQuest second edition, Jeff called a warlock, this idea of somebody who it looks quite frightening to the average Sartorite because they, you know, use weird magic and...
I mean, using dragon magic last time, it ended very well, no? So it's all good.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And the whole question is, you know, what would you do to see that the moon torn down and the empire destroyed? And what will you be afterwards? And could you ever go home at that point? You know, could you ever go home? Because, you know, what we all think about is this romantic kind of like, you know, vision of Sartar, right? You wouldn't fit in there anymore, I don't think. I think you would be so alien to that it's a real question. Could you go home?
Yeah, that's a bit like the Shire being polluted by Saruman.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Same sort of idea, right? What happens to the hobbits when they go home?
We are reaching our time limit very soon, so let's look back to Quest Worlds. So Quest Worlds, the SRD is out. It's on the Chaosium website. We'll have a link. It's on GitHub because you're a big software developer geek like me. So people can play with it now already and have been able to for quite a while because... Well, yeah, the SRD is out. The book is out soon, you mentioned. If they want to play in Glorantha with all the out-of-print stuff that they can't get because it's out of print, do you have some tips or advice or anything that might come out soon on the Johnston Compendium or whatever that would help people use Quest World to play in Glorantha?
Sure, yeah. I mean, the Quest World pack talks a little bit about creating genre packs. And then we've got a second book, which, like I say, gives the science fiction, fantasy, and superhero example, right? But the general advice I'd give is, okay, you've got a whole... We are blessed with probably the greatest number of words we've ever had on Glorantha at any point in time, thanks to a lot of, you know, the efforts that have gone on, right? So the guide and now... you know, the equivalent for all the cults and the cults books, which is, you know, a fantastic creative achievement, it has to be said. And so you've got all that wealth of material, right? So that's what you really want to use. So there are things you need to do to get a Buddha Glanton characters, right? So you need keywords. Straightforward enough, right? You can pick up a RuneQuest book. You can look and you can say, well, what are the types of professions, kind of previous experience and stuff that you can have. I'll make them keywords in my game, right? That's how you do previous experience, right? So you can come up with a list of occupations that would be appropriate to the kind of homelands. Your culture, well, again, you can look to the RuneQuest book, right? You've got the homelands you can come from. That's your culture, right? And there's enough information in those books, or even more if you can get a hold of it, the guide, right? The guide has a wealth of information about the individual Glorantha cultures, which you could draw on to say, okay, I can mine that for what we call breakouts, which are suggested abilities in the keyword, right? And then that would give you the ability to create the mundane part of a character. And then you get to incredible powers, which is the new name for extraordinary powers. So incredible powers. We name them because there are the things that help you defeat a credibility test for you. No one could possibly do that. Oh, but in genre, they've got magic, they can do that, right? So now what I do is say, well, okay, characters have spirit magic, characters have potentially rune magic, and potentially sorcery, right? So what am I going to do with that? Well, what I tend to do is say, okay, those are effectively abilities that you can have, right? And what I've done is take the three runes system a little bit, but extend it and say, okay, if I look at the RuneQuest book, it actually maps a lot more runes. So what I'd say is a rune is an incredible power ability, right? And you can have one or more runes, you just, you know, you buy them your ability slots that you are strong with, right? So you say, I'm good with the Aaron. You've probably got the others, but story terms are not important, right? You may have two or three, right? And then what you would do is take, say, spirit magic and rune magic as breakouts from that keyword. So I'm strong in the air rune. I have some air rune spirit magic, and I have some air rune magic. In terms of what's credible with it, well, you can look in the RuneQuest book or the Red Book of Magic, and you can say, okay, well, I know spirit magic lasts a couple of minutes. It has this kind of magnitude. I know rune magic lasts 15 minutes. It has this kind of magnitude. So when the player describes something, you can say, is that credible? Is that within the remit of what we think you could do? And you can even start with saying, okay, you can have a breakout that essentially is the name of a RuneQuest or a spell, a spirit magic or rune magic, right? In some of those cases, I'd say, hey, poetic names could be great, right? If we all agree that smite is bludgeon or whatever, you can have smite on your character sheet as ability. That's fine. We all know what you mean, right? And those names can be more poetic, right? And I'm sure Red Book of Magic is, you know, it's the godline of you. I'm sure Grantlands do use very poetic names.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So you can then say, well, that's fine. I can make a member of a cult, and I would say, I would use the hero quest grant to kind of model a little bit of saying, okay, provided you have a rune, which is one of the on your character sheet, which is one of the runes of that god, you can write initiate of all Anth under your air rune, right? And then effectively you're now an initiate of the cult, and then you can learn rune magic or whatever, right? And if you become a rune master, well, you've got some additional kind of things you seem to be able to do as an initiate, as a priest, right? Or a rune lord. So divine intervention or whatever, right? Okay. Well, that could be a thing we could do. Now, typically what I actually do is a thing called story points, which is a mechanism we should call hero points, which effectively, either you can just use them in quest worlds to, I'm going to have an extra success. So I just spend one of our, so it's a pool the players will draw from and have an extra success. Or I can, you can use it to say, okay, we're just going to overcome this obstacle by this story mechanism. So it's the classic example we give is there's a guard and you want to get past him. And for like one story point, it's kind of like, oh, I met him last night in the inn and I bribed him. Okay, we get past. For two story points, it's like, we served together. We served together at the battle of so-and-so, right? He's my buddy. He'll let us in, right? So one of the things I always say is, well, divine intervention, right? Just a story point, right? Explains how the story point brings you back to life, right? You pray to Wallant, and Wallant brings you back to life, right? So that's what I would do. So it's actually a general rule of thumb. You can pick up, you want to play in, you know, Forgotten Realms in a kind of, you want to play, well, probably a better way to say, you want to play the D&D movie, right? You want to play Honor Amongst Thieves, go for it, right? Look at your D&D rule book, see that it's got character classes, great, they're my occupations. Look, what are the abilities? There are kind of breakouts. What incredible powers? Oh, well, there are spells, right? Okay, how do I mirror those? And things like says, well, okay, wizards only can cast a certain number of spells per day, all right? I wouldn't force you to then say, well, I'm only going to give you three spell slots or whatever, and what about levels? That kind of thing. I just say, okay, obviously, you as a wizard only have a certain amount of spell casting you can do in a given adventure. And in story terms, if you seem to be using magic up to solve scenarios, I'll give you kind of a warning and say, well, your magic is running out, right? You're exhausted it, you're running out of spells. But I might say in quest worlds, you know, have a -5 or a -10 the next time you're doing magic until you take a rest, right? Or even say, oh, you can't use that ability until you take a rest now. And you just manage it in story terms, right? It's not credible that the wizard keeps using a spell in every encounter and wouldn't run out, okay?
Yeah.
Or you say, another way of doing it is to say, so the same with rune points and magic points. Another way to do it is to say, on what we call a 0 degree or partial kind of victory, right? So it's when we both have the same number of successes, but I have the higher roll. One thing to say is, oh, What is the penalty for your victory? You've exhausted your magic.
Yeah, so a success at a cost, or
yeah. Yeah, you've exhausted your magic now. That's the cost basically to that particular victory. So now you've got a choice: you're going to rest, or you're going to keep going without your magic. And then it's interesting story terms, right?
Yeah, and the whole thing about, like, you know, the credibility test and all that is that it relates to some terms I've learned about recently about, like, you know, high trust versus medium trust versus low trust gaming, where this is for people who trust each other, that they don't need, you know, a game system that counts the magic points and the fatigue point to know when you're fatigued. They trust each other, and specifically they trust the GM, that if the GM thinks that it's dramatically appropriate and everybody agrees that it's dramatically appropriate for you to be fatigued, then you are fatigued. And so this is,
when people get into it, the players even suggest it themselves. I think my magic is exhausted now, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to have to go into this without magic, right? Because the players want to understand that story, right? So is it interesting in the story? Because it's not interesting in the story for you to not have your magic right now, right?
So, is there, so we were talking about it a bit before, but I have to ask for the listeners, is there going to be a general pack for Glorantha? And if not, what can people do to show interest in playing Quest Worlds with Glorantha?
So, I mean, I think the focus of the line right now is on the Quest Worlds core book and the Worlds and Quests book, right? I obviously have material that could become a genre pack. I think that is more up to, that is not in my wheelhouse to decide. I think if Quest Worlds is a success and takes off, and I think if the fans say to Chaosium, we would really like to have something like that, and it is pitched very much as a here is a guidebook to using the RuneQuest material, that might be something that happens. But I don't get to make that call. Mm-hmm. So it's up to the bosses to decide what do they want to do, right? Do they want to make it give people a sort of handy guide to what I just describing, which is how to effectively run RuneQuest material but using the Quest World engine instead?
Which is super easy because Quest World is so bare bones and simple. So
I mean, I've done a few things, right, about Quest World. And one of them is, you know, some folks say, oh, you shouldn't, you know, you could just run anything now, right? And that's only true if we all basically understand the genre. So if we all have a shared understanding of the genre, sure, you can make up keywords in 5 minutes and run a game. But if we don't, then that's when you're in a genre pack, right? So if I'm going to produce, so one of our settings coming up is Pioneer Space, very much what we call rocket punk. So 1950s science fiction without some of the worst excesses of 1950s science fiction, you know, racism, sexism, all the isms basically pushed to one side, and techno-optimistic kind of future kept sort of thing, right? Mm-hmm. If I wanted to play that, you need a guide to the setting, right? And you need some suitable keywords, and you want probably to me to tell you about incredible powers, which in that case is technology or psi powers, right? Now, you could make that up, but actually, you know, why not get a genre pack from somebody else that tells you that? And it tells you what is credible in the setting and that kind of thing, right? So that notion of credibility becomes quite important, the idea of, sure, I could do that, but do we all agree on the setting and what's credible? Or do we want a handy guide I can give you that means you don't have to go and watch all the Star Wars movies and play half the video games and read the expanded universe library? You can just read the summary and that'll be fine. We'll all get into it together, right?
I mean, even then, I think the genre pack, even if everybody understands the genre or the references, I think the genre pack has the good role of establishing a common translation. Like, even if everybody has seen Star Wars, not everybody might agree that, okay, you know, Chewie piloting the Millennium Falcon is actually a 25 ability.
Yeah, yeah.
And some people might say, oh, no, it's only like a 15. Or so that also gives you a common translation codex, even if everybody's familiar with the genre.
And the other thing I also discovered interesting about Glorantha, which is very interesting second edition, was playing it with folks who had no exposure to Glorantha, right? So they're D&D players, right? And I started playing with them in the pandemic, Charlotte and Lucas and Tim, et cetera, who I'd met at UK Games Expo. And in the pandemic, all the groups are shut down. We got a line, started playing, and I was like, hey, I've got this Dragon Rise campaign. I'll play that with you. They're running a Coming Storm quite a few times, right? So, one of the things I learned that is, of course, coming from a background with not much knowledge of Glorantha, right? What can my magic do, right? Mm-hmm, you say I've got an air rune. Does that mean I'm an airbender, like an avatar? What can I do, right, yes, with my air rune?
Yeah, yeah.
And without some kind of genre pack, it's difficult to answer those questions, right? And I could have just picked up the Red Book of Magic and said, here, read your Red Book of Magic. That's kind of what we're thinking.
Yeah.
But that's quite a lot, right? It would be better to have a few paragraphs I could give them and actually have some spell lists again, which we dropped for Hero Quest 2nd Edition, but actually it was quite useful for them to have suggested spells. Not saying those are the only ones,
yeah.
But here are some examples to give you a feel of the power ranges and that kind of thing, right? If you understand that a lot of rune spells are things like shield and warding and true sword and things like that, you get a feel for what it is, because they're not meteor swarm or, you know, or limited wish, right? So I get it now. I get what kind of get I'm playing.
Jörg, do you have any last words, question, thoughts about Quest Worlds?
None that will interest the general public, I feel.
Well, we can talk some more after the end of the episode. But in the meantime, everybody, you know what to do. Please buy Quest Worlds when it comes out. Please, please, please do it.
Yeah. Try it out.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, games, you just keep playing, right?
You can just buy it and not play it if you're not interested, but still buy it. But yeah, preferably play it. You'll see that you'll like it. Thanks again, Jan, for your time. That was great.
Just one point I'd like to just leave for people to think on, right, is I enjoy BRP too, right? It's not an either or, all right? It's not like you have to be in one tribe or the other. Yes. It's okay to like both, and it's okay to decide the kind of game I want to play is Quest World. The kind of game I want to play is RuneQuest, right? You'll know, if I want to do a adventure crawling through the rubble where desperate adventurers seek gold and glory, I'm going to do that in RuneQuest, yes. Right? Because it has the resource-based mechanics and the grittiness and the fear of death that I'm looking for, right? If I want to do something which is a story about how somebody has to return home and face the fact that their brother has become a tyrant, right? I might do that in Quest Worlds. And so it's just different tools in your box to tell different kinds of stories. And so that's the thing I tell people with BRP. It's another tool. It's another tool that you can use in the same way you've got other tools in your box. And it doesn't mean you've somehow betrayed BRP. And, you know, it's like you're allowed to see other systems. It's kind of an open, yeah. An open relationship, right, with role-playing systems.
Yeah. And I think that's indeed a very important point. Like, we all like Lorentha. This is why we're here. And I think Lorentha is like so compelling that it supports a lot of different stories. And you don't want to tell all those stories with the same system. You want to actually use one or the other system, or even 13th Age in some cases or whatever. So to me, it's important to have multiple systems to play in Lorentha. Anyway, thanks a lot, Ian.
Thank you very much for having me. That was lovely to come and have a chat. Lovely to see you both. And I'll see you hopefully at Chaosium Con.
Me, hopefully, yes, maybe.
Yeah, not a chance.
Yeah, we need.
And I'll see you at Kraken or something in Saudi, probably.
Yeah, I'll put all that. Yeah.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the God Learners. Our website is godlearners.com, where you can find episodes, newsletters, and articles about Lorentha. Reach us via email at collective@godlearners.com or via Twitter or Facebook at The God Learners for any questions or feedback. We are The God Learners. Question everything to the void and beyond.